Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. First, we'll examine how Bernie Madoff made off with $50 billion of his clients' money in the context of a wider financial meltdown on Wall Street, where a few insiders took down the global economy, which is yet to bottom out. I will speak with Gary Aguirre, who headed a major SEC investigation of one of the world's largest hedge funds for insider trading and market manipulation. He testified in 2006 before the U.S. Senate committee regarding the risks hedge funds pose to the capital markets and to the failure of the regulatory system to contain those risks. Last year, he assisted the Senate committee in drafting a bill to regulate hedge funds. And Gary Aguirre has been an outspoken critic of the SEC, saying that, quoting, "We can't have two sets of security laws, one set for those with political connections or those who have the right contacts, and another set for the rest of us. When evidence points the SEC to powerful people, the umpire is looking the other way when he ought to be calling the violation." And then we look at the bailout of Detroit that was almost thwarted by Southern senators and examine why the South wants to destroy Detroit and break the UAW. We'll be joined by Michael Lind, who is a Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush, and The Southern Takeover of American Politics, and What Lincoln Believed, his groundbreaking study of the American Grand Strategy, the American Way of Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy, and the American Way of Life, was published by Oxford University Press in October 2006. In his new article published in Salon.com, available now online, Michael Lind suggests that the South is engaged in a form of renewed civil war as its senators opposed a bailout for the northern auto industry while they give subsidies to foreign manufacturers making their non-union workers, making cars with non-union workers in their states. And it leaves us with the question, the choice actually, either the reconstruction of the South or the deconstruction of the U.S. economy. And then in the third segment, we'll look at Obama's Green Team. We'll go to Paris, since the Europeans are much further along in terms of a green economy, while the United States has been in the grip of the oil, gas, and coal lobby under the Bush-Cheney regime. We'll speak with Dr. Robert Bell, who's a professor of management and chairman of the economics department at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. He is the author of The Green Bubble, Waste into Wealth, The New Energy Revolution, and he was the featured speaker for the Fast 50 Awards ceremony at the Paris Bourse, that's the stock exchange, and the inaugural speaker, the HEC Deloitte Club of Energy and Finance at La Maison des Politiques Nationales in Paris in November 2007. I'm now speaking with Gary Aguirre, who headed a major SEC investigation of one of the world's largest hedge funds for insider trading and market manipulation. He testified in 2006 before the U.S. Senate committee regarding the risks hedge funds pose to the capital markets and the failure of the regulatory system to contain those risks. And last year, he assisted the Senate committee in drafting a bill to regulate hedge funds. Just quoting from Gary's outspoken critique of the SEC, "We can't have two sets of security laws, one set for those with political connections or those with the right contacts, and another set for the rest of us. When evidence points the SEC to powerful people, the umpire is looking the other way when he ought to be calling the violation." And Gary Aguirre, I'm just looking at now at a copy of a complaint that was lodged with the SEC in November 7th, 2005, submitted to the SEC by Harry Markopoulos. He originally, in 1999, submitted a complaint to the SEC calling Bernie Madoff's organization the world's biggest Ponzi scheme. And just quoting from this report from 2005, he says, "Therefore, it is far more likely that Bernie Madoff is a Ponzi scheme. Front-running is a very simple fraud to commit and requires only access to inside information. The elaborateness of Bernie Madoff's fundraising, his need for secrecy, his high 16% average cost of funds, and reliance on derivatives investment schemes that few investors or regulators would be capable of comprehending lead to a weight of the evidence conclusion that this is a Ponzi scheme. How come nobody listened?
That's the $64,000 question. The Madoff fraud is a new low at the SEC. Over the past year, there have been revelations that the SEC failed to detect other types of fraud and market abuse. We're looking at the within the SEC, the CSE unit that failed to detect that Bear Stearns was facing imminent collapse. We've had the SEC fail to detect the market abuse and insider trading that ravages the market. And now the Madoff affair is perhaps the most stunning of all, not in dollar terms, because although $60 billion sounds like a lot of money, it's very much pocket change to the massive losses that the capital markets are experiencing now. What is different about Madoff is that it is in the SEC's long suit. Investor fraud is probably the strongest suit of the SEC. They've been doing it a long time. They know how to do it. And then the largest Ponzi scheme of all time is presented to them in the form of a blueprint with 29 red flags waving, according to the report that you're referring to now. How they missed it, how they could not detect it with that much evidence presented to them is beyond mere incompetence.
So what could the explanation be? There's a story now that Bernie Madoff's niece was an in-house counsel for his investment firm, and she's apparently married to an SEC official, but nobody seems to think that that's the full explanation.
Well, I think back about how the investigation that I headed was derailed. And what happened is we were proceeding, the team I was heading, was proceeding with the investigation. It seemed to be going well. We were getting glowing feedback from our supervisors. And then a phone call came in to the head of the Division of Enforcement. And that phone call put a hold on the case. It got derailed. That got passed down the chain of command to me, and I was told to put a hold on it. That's what I suspect happened here. In other words, the evidence doesn't make much difference. You may have 29 red flags waving, but if someone with influence can call the head of the SEC and say in so many words, I just don't think there's a case there, and somebody's listening at the top of the SEC, the case can go away. And it can go away without regard to what the evidence is.
And do you experience that at the SEC? And you say you had a strong case against this hedge fund, which was derailed by a superior. What is the recourse for the rank and file within the SEC?
Well, let me just clarify. On the case that I had, it was an early point in the investigation. The case seemed to be going quite well. And then we got the word which came down the chain of command that basically derailed the investigation. Now, what I think, what's going on at the SEC is that it has completely lost the focus on its mission. When the market crashed in 1929, we had 4 years of pain. Around 1933, the Senate Banking Committee conducted an investigation of the rubble that had been our financial markets. It was concluded that two dynamics brought about the crash. Number one, high levels of speculation, leverage upon leverage upon leverage upon leverage. Secondly, it was widespread market abuse. The SEC, and that market abuse, by the way, was not by low-level players. It was by Wall Street's elite, the top folks, the heads of the banks, the head of the New York Stock Exchange. Presidents of major banks were shorting the stock of, borrowing money from their banks to short sell the stock of their bank. What the SEC was created to keep an eye on Wall Street. It was created in 1934. Now, what's happened is that mission has been diluted over time. And now the primary focus of those that run the SEC is, at least in my judgment, is their next job. They rotate out of the SEC, where they may be making $200,000 a year, into Wall Street firms, where the starting salary may be $2 million a year. And then it's up from there. Now, when they leave the SEC, they leave with a Rolodex. And that Rolodex is gold. They can call back to the SEC, and as happened in my case, they can call the director of the division in enforcement and suggest how they see the case. Now, the people handling the case may never be involved in those discussions, as I was not in the discussion that brought it into the case that I had been handling. And there lies, I think, the primary problem with the SEC. It's the culture. I addressed Congress about this in 2006. Senate recommended some changes at the SEC, and obviously the Madoff case demonstrates beyond any question of a doubt, any shadow of a doubt, that nothing has changed at the SEC.
Well, you just mentioned, Gary, that the formation of the SEC in 1934 by Roosevelt. I understood that one of the biggest players on Wall Street who was gaming the system, Joe Kennedy, the father of President John F. Kennedy, and Senators Robert and Ted, and now, of course, the grandfather, I guess, of the new senator of New York, that this was a case of putting the fox in charge of the hen house. So what's happened to that kind of dynamic? In other words, why do we have people who are complicitous rather than people who are doing the advocates for the public and for most importantly, the investor?
That question needs to be directed at Christopher Dodd, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, and Senator Shelby, the minority leader, and Senator Schumer from New York, because those are the three most powerful people on the Senate Banking Committee. And they have the responsibility for passing on whoever is appointed as the chairman of the SEC. And, you know, when President-elect Obama said the other day that our regulators have been asleep at the switch and some congressional committees have been asleep at the switch, he was referring to, at least in my judgment, to the Senate Banking Committee. And they've been more than asleep at the switch. Senator Schumer is Wall Street's man in the Congress. He over the past year, has been able to tap into Wall Street funding sources. In the last election, going back to the fall of 2004, before the election, there was a major shift in contributions. The financial services industry moved away from contributing to Republicans. I think they had gamed how that the election was going to come out and swung their financial support to the Democrats. And the shift from a Republican to a Democratic control of the banking committee does not make a shade of difference in the way it operates. So the problem begins with the SEC, but the SEC is the way it is because the Senate Banking Committee allows it to be exactly that way, and that's the problem we face.
Well, indeed, Senator Schumer apparently is responsible for there were efforts to tax some of these hedge fund managers who have been the only beneficiaries of this financial meltdown. A number of them, including people like Paulson, they only pay 15% tax, it's an outrage, but he managed to block efforts to bring about some fairness.
Well, I saw I saw Senator Schumer in action in the Senate, in the investigation by the Senate of the SEC's handling of my investigation. Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate Finance Committee were conducting an investigation after the Senate Banking Committee had passed on the investigation. There was a hearing in June of 2005 before the Senate Judiciary Committee when Chairman Specter was presiding. Senator Schumer appeared at that hearing and tried to derail the Judiciary Committee investigation of the SEC for stopping the investigation I was heading. Now, there was evidence before that committee. It's been published in a report, that is, by the Senate Judiciary Committee, describing how the investigation was halted, the phone calls involved, the evidence that supported going ahead with the investigation. And in light of all of that, Senator Schumer came over and tried to stop the investigation. Now, while he was trying to stop the investigation, it was clear that it was that the Banking Committee was not going to go anywhere with it. So basically what Senator Schumer was trying to do was to stop any congressional investigation of how the SEC had blown it in my case. Now, what I was saying was that the SEC's deference to Wall Street had stopped the investigation I was handling, was contrary to the SEC's mission, and if the SEC failed its mission, we were headed back for a rendezvous with 1929. And I think that's exactly what's happened.
Well, Gary, are you suggesting then that it doesn't matter whether we've got people like Christopher Cox who are manifestly failed in their oversight duties? We've had a history of the Congress taking money away from enforcement budgets. There seems to be an overall process here to defang the SEC. It's pretty clearly on the record. So it's not a systemic problem in terms of the people in the agency itself. You maintain that it's the oversight people in the Congress who are the main problem.
Well, no, I think it's both. I think that there is a culture within the SEC at odds with its mission. And then you have to say, well, why is that culture permitted? Why does the Senate go along with it? And then you have to look at the Senate Banking Committee. Now, of course, the president-elect could do something about it. He could bring in a chairman like the SEC had in 1938, William O. Douglas. Douglas came in. He knew that the SEC had to focus on Wall Street. His mere presence at the SEC attracted people who shared the view that the SEC ought to be an effective regulator. Now, the choice by Senator Obama as the current chair, Mary Shapiro, let's say the jury's out on that one. We'll find out when she steps in and starts making some calls. But absent strong executive direction to the SEC, and now I'm talking perhaps about some of the other appointments to the commission, it's going to be business as usual.
Now, she, the new appointee, Mary Shapiro, she's headed up Wall Street's own watchdog organization. And how do they compare to the SEC? You're giving us a pretty bleak picture of the SEC. What's the self-regulatory body like?
Well, the self-regulatory bodies have never worked, and they didn't work in 1929. And recently, Chairman Cox has been saying, you know, we thought self-regulation would work, and now we're finding that it doesn't work.
Yeah, that's the former head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, said,
well,
essentially. You know
let me talk about the thin capitalization, probably the single major cause of the crash that we have right now is multiple levels of leverage and speculation. That's very similar to what we had in 1929. Only the architecture is a little different. Now, that architecture involves, first of all, highly thinly capitalized banks. And added on to that, we have, in terms of their balance sheets, they're thinly capitalized. Off the balance sheet, we have multiple levels of additional leverage. Take Bear Stearns in March of 2008. It had a net worth of around $12 billion and liabilities of around $400 billion. In short, it had about a 40-to-1 ratio of debt to equity. Off its balance sheet, it had huge exposures. For example, it was holding $2.5 trillion in credit default swaps, roughly 2,000 times its net worth. Now, how did that come about? The SEC, again, was supposed to be keeping an eye. They had a special unit within the SEC that was supposed to be keeping an eye on the liquidity of the banks and the liquidity and the capitalization of the banks. It utterly failed, and that failure was evidence, the failure of Bear Stearns, that we ought to be taking a look at the rest of our banks. I sent a letter to Senator Grassley shortly after the Bear Stearns collapse, suggesting that we ought to be taking a look at the other banks and laying out some numbers, and he sent a request over to the SEC's IG. They opened an investigation and concluded that the SEC's CSE unit was failing across the board. The day that report came out, the SEC disbanded. Chairman Cox ended the CSE program. Now, the theory of government that self-discipline has a name. Chairman Bernanke and others have referred to it as counterparty discipline. This concept of counterparty discipline means that the banks would somehow discipline themselves, and that, for example, a Goldman Sachs wouldn't loan too much money, it wouldn't take too much risk. Well, that's not how the market works. When profits are coming in, when it looks rosy, when it looks bullish, there are no limits. Nobody says, look, I'm not going to do that risky deal. You're going to have to go across the street to Morgan Stanley if you want to do that. They'll beat the risky deal that Morgan Stanley has with even a more risky deal. So there was no self-imposed regulation. The concept of counterparty discipline was a complete myth. Yet, Senator Bernanke Chairman Bernanke and Secretary of Treasury Paulson talk about counterparty discipline as if it's a force of gravity. It's a myth.
Well, Gary, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I'd like to do a follow-up with you because I still am astounded that so few people could take down the global financial system. And it's an extraordinary, and Madoff is just a sort of metaphor for the broader question of what happened to Wall Street. And these questions need to be answered. I thank you so much for joining
us. Surely. It's a pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking there with Gary Aguirre, who headed up a major SEC investigation into one of the world's largest hedge funds for insider trading and market manipulation. He testified in 2006 before the U.S. Senate committee regarding the risks of hedge funds posed to the capital markets and the failure of the regulatory system to contain those risks. And last year, he assisted the Senate committee in drafting a bill to regulate hedge funds. And as he pointed out, the investigation that he was heading up inside the SEC was derailed by a phone call to the top people in the agency. I'm now speaking with Michael Lynn, who is the Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. He's the author of a number of books, including Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And he has an article published in Salon.com suggesting that the South is engaged in a form of renewed civil war as its senators opposed a bailout for the North's auto industry while they give subsidies to foreign manufacturers who make cars with non-union workers in their states. And It's an extraordinary thing to watch, the civil war sort of playing out here between Southern senators and the desperate plight of Detroit. And of course, the president came up with $74 billion, a bit of a cliffhanger there. And the head of the UAW is complaining that President Bush put in a bunch of conditions, essentially punishing the auto workers for the plight of the industry. What's happening here? And you pointed out in your article, Michael Lind, why aren't more people shocked in the United States to see this collaboration of the Southern senators with the foreign economic rivals of the United States to compete against other United States? I mean, it's as though it's acceptable for American states to connive with Asia and European countries in the destruction of American industry.
Well, that's exactly right, Ian. And as I suggest in my Salon article, the shocking thing is that people are not shocked. If you look at the European Union, there you have a lot of sovereign nation states which have banded together with common labor standards, common workplace practices, even common wages to a certain extent, in order to compete with the United States, Japan, and China. If you were a British politician and you said, well, we're going to team up with the Americans and the Japanese to completely destroy the German auto industry, you would be considered an unpatriotic European. Yet if you're an American and you say, well, you want the Alabama auto industry to destroy the Michigan auto industry, then this is somehow compatible with patriotism.
So I try to understand the political motives of Senators Shelby and Corker and others, but I don't understand the mentality of the workers in the South, because in effect, what's happening is that the reason that they have reasonably decent wages that are not as good as UAW, but they're fairly commensurate, is because the UAW is trying to unionize these, and the Nissans and the Mercedes and the Volkswagens, etc., pay these guys more in the South than they would in order to hold the UAW at bay. The minute the UAW went away, these people would have their wages slashed.
Well, it's a tragic situation where the elite in the South, including the politicians along with local industry, are cynically playing one group of Southern citizens off against another. The only reason those automobile factories are in the South, in most cases, is because of massive tax abatements by Southern state and local governments, by tax subsidies, luring these foreign corporations there. And because of the loss in state revenue as a result of those tax abatements, you have to raise taxes on middle-class and working-class Southerners. So it's not simply that one group of workers are being pitted against one another, but the interests of Southern taxpayers are being sacrificed to these foreign corporations and to the politicians who favor this strategy.
Well, I'm just going back to the Civil War itself, and apparently, you know, in the South, it's as though the war of aggression from the North happened yesterday in many quarters. I don't understand the mentality. Effectively, these young farmers and blacksmiths and carpenters who fought for the Confederacy, they were most of them were too poor to own slaves, and ultimately they were fighting for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves.
Well, that's right, but also if you look at the history of the war itself, it was the poor white hill country regions of the South, including eastern Tennessee and the Texas country, parts of Mississippi and Arkansas, where the poor whites were the most likely to quit, refuse to fight for the slave owners. Also, in the case of eastern Tennessee and west central Texas, there were a lot of unionists from those regions. So the thing that people outside of the South, I'm a Southerner myself, need to understand is that the right and the South are not synonymous. The conservatives have dominated the South for most of its history, but they're extremely insecure. The very reason racial laws were that repressive is because they knew knew you would have racial intermarriage if they weren't. You would have to have all of these anti-union laws in the southern states if the southern elites were not afraid correctly that given the opportunity, southerners would unionize. So this is an insecure elite, and it's a mistake for people in the blue states in particular to just say, oh, those, you know, cretinous southern morons. In fact, there was a great deal of support for populism in the 19th century and for neoliberalism in the middle of the 20th century. So I think that liberals need to see the South as a region of their fellow Americans who need to be liberated from local tyranny, rather than enemies who should be booted out of the country, as all too often suggested, unfortunately.
No, I couldn't agree with you more, Michael Linden. In fact, I remember interviewing Joe Bagent, who's lives in Southern Virginia.
A brilliant writer,
and he castigates liberals in the Democratic Party for not understanding these people who would you know, who are overworked, underpaid, and undereducated, and wouldn't.
Can I get back to this union question?
Sure.
See, there's been an alliance between anti-union businesses nationwide and Southern politicians since the 1930s. When Southern conservative Democrats teamed up with Republican businessmen in the Northeast and Midwest in order to weaken or kill pro-union legislation. And so you had the conservative coalition formed in the late 1930s. They resisted Franklin Roosevelt, and they made sure that you would not have strong federal union laws. What that means was that as early as the 1950s, the South became a region where so-called right-to-work laws, which are really anti-union legislation, made it attractive for businesses to move their production from New England and the Midwest to the South. Now, the Southern politicians and business leaders could never have done this by themselves. They always had allies on Wall Street. They always had allies in the corporate headquarters in the Northeast and the Midwest. So this is sort of a class struggle at the same time that it's a regional struggle.
So, how do you liberate the South?
Well, as I suggested in my Salon article, what you have to do is level the playing field by raising the floor. That means a federal living wage. You take away from Southern states the abilities to set the minimum federal minimum wage we have now is about. Slightly more than half of what it was in the 1960s when you adjust for inflation. Now, this is somewhat utopian, but the editors of Salon asked me, if you want to create a single integrated national economy, what do you do? And I said, well, you raise the minimum wage, which would disproportionately help the Southern workers. You have federal revenue sharing so that you have first-rate schools and public services for people in Mississippi and for Latinos in New Mexico and other poor states. And finally, you outlaw, you use the federal commerce power to outlaw these race-to-the-bottom, beggar-thy-neighbor strategies on the parts of different states. For example, it's one thing if a state wants to have a bond issue, a municipal bond issue, in order to build better schools and roads to make itself more competitive. That's perfectly fine. But a lot of state governments have industrial revenue bonds. And similar municipal bonds, which are used actually to pay individual companies, or at least to pay for tax abatements to lure individual companies to their states. Now, that can't be tolerated, and Congress, if it wanted to, could outlaw that. It could do it indirectly because most of these bonds are tax-exempt. And if you simply remove the tax exemption on bonds that were part of this beggar-thy-neighbor strategy, then that would reduce their attraction to a lot of these southern states right away. So there are things you can do, but you would have to have defeat not only southern state governments and their representatives in Congress, but also their conservative and libertarian allies in other parts of the country.
Well, to some extent, Michael Lind, I think the last elections maybe didn't defeat them, but it probably knocked them off their stride a little bit. But still, the question remains in terms of a race to the bottom. You were suggesting, you know, the alternative to the southernization of the United States is the Americanization of the South. But surely, you know, we need a broader social contract, don't we? With globalization, it seems to be there's no sanction for an American capitalist to destroy a town, whether it's in the North or the South, and move his plant to Bangladesh, and he can live in Bermuda and not pay taxes.
That's right. However, I don't think that world conditions will permit us to negotiate common standards with the developing countries like India and China. We could have a transatlantic community modeled on the European community. That's still somewhat utopian, but at least it's imaginable with common worker standards and various other things. In the meantime, since China and Japan are unlikely to give up their mercantilist practices targeting American industry, we can insist on reciprocity in trade. And we can also indirectly, without abandoning free trade for tariffs, we can promote manufacturing in the United States everywhere, north and south, by a variety of measures. For example, Ralph Gomery, the former chief scientist at IBM, a leading economist, has suggested that the corporate income tax should be lowered for companies that do high value-added top-end work in the United States. That's a very interesting suggestion that I think should be pursued.
But is there also a component here, Michael Lynn, in terms of the American citizens themselves, particularly now with growing unemployment, that you know, there may be a backlash, but there may be greater passivity? My question has always been, in terms of the politics, which is that we are unique amongst the industrial nations in as much as we vote. We don't have this simple arrangement with our politicians where you pay your taxes and get your services. We don't seem to expect anything back, you know, arguing about burning flags and prayer in school and abortion and all these extraneous things. In other words, until the citizens themselves take back their government and demand better return on their tax money and more economic fairness, it seems to me that the system will continue.
Well, I'm somewhat more skeptical than you are. I think that most citizens, partly because they're busy, you know, they're working one or two jobs with long hours. You know, they're in many cases inadequate as schooling. They don't have the time or the ability to devote to public affairs. At the end of the day, you get reform in this country when there is a division within the elite, within the political and the economic elites. And the reformists in the elite, along with popular support, defeat the reactionaries. I think that things are in such flux now, and the existing system has been so utterly discredited, first by the Iraq War and now by the economic, that you're getting a lot of members of the elite who would have been quite complacent a few years ago. Potentially, they're converts, and they can be allies in reform efforts. You need popular participation, but successful rebellions include leadership from above, you know, not just rebellion from people below who are disorganized and often uninformed.
But given that the only game in town that's left now is the federal government, and we're going to, you know, be experiencing a sort of new deal, doesn't that to some extent empower the possibility of change and a greater economic fairness?
Oh, I think so. What we're getting is bad state capitalism, the federal government as a capitalist, basically as a vulture capitalist coming in, buying up failed firms and entire industries like banking and now the automobile industry. What we need is a permanent role of the federal government as a state capitalist working with private capital, including private foreign capital, in the interest of long-term economic development that benefits all Americans, not just a few. Now, the attempts of the New Deal to create that kind of long-range planning and federal investment capability were crippled, as I say, in the late 1930s and in the 1940s by a coalition of conservative Democrats in the South and by northern conservatives. But that's the direction to go. That's where most other industrial countries, in one way or another, they're all quite different. Japan's not France, and France is not Sweden. All of them see the basic goal is one of partnership and collaboration between government and business, not simply dismantling government to get out of the way of business.
Well, just in closing then, Michael Lind, I mean, it seems to me that this, you know, we have the one of the least unionized working forces in the world, and it's gone down considerably and steadily since the 40s, I think, you know, from something like 30% down to what, barely...
It's about 7% in the private sector now.
Right. It's extraordinary. And it's a... And
one in 10 Americans in the private sector.
And then you've got this advertising campaign out there now to even weaken unions even further. What is it about... Is it about our culture that doesn't understand that the simple fact that union, the more labor force is unionized, the better working conditions and wages are?
Well, it's the thing that makes people suspicious of big business and big banking. They're suspicious of big labor. We have a Jeffersonian populist, Lockean liberal culture that's suspicious of all large organizations, government, business, and labor. And that's very difficult to overcome. And to some degrees, it's a good thing. You know, the craft union model that we had in the United States is inferior to the industrial union model they have in most other industrial countries. And there are some innovative union thinkers who are coming up with so-called hiring hall unionism, where it's almost like a temp agency that provides your benefits while you work on contract or temporarily for different employers. So I don't think we should necessarily defend the rather unsuccessful model of unionization that we've had in the United States, but there's no doubt whatsoever, if you look at comparative studies, the reason why inequality has grown so dramatically in the United States since the 70s is not primarily globalization, and it's not primarily technological change, because if that were true, there would be this enormous growth in inequality in all of the other industrial countries. In fact, there hasn't been. There's been not by the same measure. Well, what's the difference? Well, the other countries, a far higher percentage of the workforce, including the service sector workforce, is unionized. Hmm. And you see this even if you look at other English-speaking countries like Canada and the UK. If you control for unionization, inequality is reduced commensurately. So there's no way we're going to overcome this degree of inequality unless workers have more leverage, and unionization, along with a tight labor market and other things, is one of the things that gives them leverage in insisting that they share some of the gains of productivity.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking with Michael Lind, who's a Whitehead Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and he has an article in the current issue on Salon.com about the economic civil war. The South's attempt to kill the North's auto industry is the latest battle in an ongoing conflict. It's time for a third reconstruction to put an end to it. I'm now speaking with Dr. Robert Bell, who's a professor of management and the chairman of the economics department at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Green Bubble, Waste into Wealth, The New Energy Revolution, and he was the featured speaker at the Fast 50 Awards ceremony at the Paris Bourse, which is their stock exchange in Paris, and it was the inaugural speaker at the HEC Deloitte Club of Energy and Finance at Les Maisons des Polytechniciens in Paris in November of 2007. And you are in Europe, and of course the Europeans are ahead of us in terms of the green economy. The last 8 years, the United States has been in the grip of the oil and gas and coal lobby under the Bush-Cheney regime. So do you think this new green team here in the United States is going to turn it around?
I think they will, and it isn't only entirely out of choice, but it's also out of desperation. I think that the economic collapse that we're seeing is actually a spectacular opportunity to turn this around. The Obama team has been leaking out how big the economic stimulus will be. The latest figures today indicate it could be $850 billion over 2 years. What percentage of that will go into renewable energy has not been announced. But there have been also leaks that it could be $100 to $200 billion over the next 2 years. That's vastly more than was talked about in the election campaign, where they talked about $150 billion over 10 years. To put this into perspective, in this year, 2008, there will be, according to New Energy Finance that tracks this thing, an outfit in London, there will be approximately $142 billion spent worldwide on renewable energy. And of that, about $80 billion will go into asset development, which is wind farms and photovoltaic installations, and factories to build them, biofuel refineries, that sort of thing.
Well, there's
Sorry,
go ahead.
No, so I think that the Obama administration is quite clear that the Obama administration is trying to reflate the economy using massive deficit spending. We already have massive deficit spending under the Bush gang, despite themselves. That's what they're doing in order to keep the economy from an utter collapse. And it will be even bigger under the Obama administration with a focus on something useful.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Under the Bush gang, the reflation, the money that's being spent, there's nothing to show for it.
Right.
Presumably, under the Obama administration, we're hoping that we get something to show for it.
Quite a bit, I think. And we should just be thankful every day that McCain didn't win this election. His plan had been 45 new nuclear reactors by 2030, 45 of them. We don't know if we'll get any new nuclear reactors under Obama. He's appointed two major physicists into top positions, but both of them are strongly green figures, really interesting, truly interesting people.
Well, any physicist who's a real physicist would know that they haven't figured out the last part of the nuclear cycle, which is the waste problem.
Well, Senator Reid has put paid to the story of the Yucca Mountain repository. He said in a Nevada newspaper that he wouldn't approve any Secretary of Energy that was for opening the Yucca Mountain facility. And when Dr. Chu was nominated, he said in the press, "I'm going to see to it that he is confirmed as fast as possible." So I think that's the end of Yucca Mountain. However, you can build reactors without having that facility, but you can't have a massive buildup of them, which is what McCain wanted. Reactors are crazy in terms of a quick deficit, attempt to reflate the economy, because they have no payback for so long. It takes 5 to 10 years to build those things, and you don't have one volt of electricity that comes out of them until the whole thing is built.
Right, they last for 30 years, and then they themselves become a massive repository of nuclear waste.
The embedded energy in the thing is just catastrophic. But the point is, you throw up a wind turbine, and six months from the day you get permission, you can have electricity pumping out. So to some degree, they are self-financing. They are finally totally self-financing, but they are immediately self-financing. So in terms of reflating the economy, renewable energy, certain parts of it are absolutely great.
So just in terms of the politics of it, though, it does look as if what Obama's doing here is he's going to run so much more out of the White House and less out of the cabinet positions. It's interesting to see that he's got Carol Brown, who used to be the EPA director under Clinton.
And Al Gore's protege.
Yeah, and she's in the White House. And you've got Tom Daschle in the White House as a health czar.
Right.
She's the energy czar. And then you've got, of course, Lawrence Summers in there, to some extent, the economic czar. So what do you think of that idea that... And also, it's interesting to note that a lot of these other cabinet appointees have green connections. Hilda Solis, Labor, her focus is on green jobs.
Yeah.
Even the National Security Advisor, when he left the military, he went straight. General Jones. He went straight into a green energy company. He recognizes that it's a national security imperative for the United States to get out of get away from its dependence on Middle East oil.
The evidence so far is that the Greens won this election in the United States. That's the way it looks. Everything is falling into place for a massive industrial buildup of green technology that works now. That's the whole point. Nothing new actually new things will be invented, but nothing actually has to be invented to go into massively in the green direction. Wind turbines work great now. Photovoltaic, great. Solar thermal, great. So we have technology that works now that can be put in place immediately and get an immediate payback in terms of generating money.
Well, this would have to be done on a massive scale, though, wouldn't it?
Well,
solar, particularly.
If you look at the Al Gore's plan, is called Repower America. If you go to their website, it's quite interesting to see what the plan is. By 2020, the plan would be 27% of U.S. energy would be from wind. 3% would be from photovoltaic. Solar thermal would provide 13%. The big factor in it in this would be 28%, which would come from energy efficiency. But it's very important to note that that is not a baloney term, energy efficiency. That does not mean that everybody has to use less. That means that things can function much more cleverly than before. It doesn't even necessarily mean electronic gadgets, although there will be plenty of them. It doesn't even necessarily mean a smart grid, although I think we will have that. It's things that are as simple as insulation, double glazing, and a technology that is increasingly applied in Europe but is hardly known in the United States, something called a Canadian well, which is simply a 100-foot-long pipe in the ground that's about 11 inches in diameter, buried about 7 feet down, and it acts as a heat exchanger, and so the air comes in at the outside end and goes into the house, the building, just runs into the building. A little electric fan about the size of a fan in a hairdryer keeps the air flowing, and the air is cooled down to the temperature at 7 feet depth, which is about 55 degrees Fahrenheit, 12 degrees centigrade. Worldwide, that's what it is, unless there's some particular geothermal property. It's mm-hmm. 12 degrees everywhere on planet Earth. And you can actually air condition a house almost for free with that. So energy efficiency means is a really viable concept.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Bell, who's a professor of management and chairman of the economics department at the Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Green Bubble, Waste into Wealth, The New Energy Revolution. And he's in Paris, France, and as I mentioned in the opening, the Europeans have been investing for some time in alternative energy, and of course they've also went along with the Kyoto protocols, which one of the first acts of President Bush was to renege on that, on what Clinton had promised. And of course in the last 8 years the United States has been in the grip of the oil and gas lobby, represented by these two oil men in the White House.
And it would have been in the grip of the nuclear lobby had McCain
right.
won the election. It's very important to note that most of the major companies, which will probably be the major company that exists now, which will probably continue to be the major companies as this massive industrial buildup in green energy takes place, most of them are European companies.
And Chinese own all the solar, don't they?
No. They're big, but the biggest ones are Japan and Germany. Q-cells in Germany.
I thought here in the United States, most of the solar companies were owned by the Chinese.
No. The two big ones in the United States are SunPower and First Solar.
Uh-huh.
And although First Solar sells most of its output, which is thin film solar, they sell most of their output in Germany. But they're based out there in California. Both.
Huh.
Well, First Solar is in Arizona, based in Arizona.
Well, so. Is there any incentive, in other words, the oil and gas lobby, and what's interesting in the coal lobby as well, you know, the coal lobby and the oil and gas lobby, they advertise on television for all the news shows, you know, and
right.
the current affairs and on PBS, et cetera. So they're clearly targeting opinion to keep people, and they put out such lying garbage like clean coal, which is such an absurd idea, and this this completely bogus notion of sequestering CO2, which is total scientific nonsense, but somehow they keep repeating it. But the long and the short of it is, if these people now aren't in, don't have their grip on the country like they had under Bush and Cheney, is there any way to incentivize them to for example, to switch to natural gas, which is what T. Boone Pickens was talking about? Or is that that they don't have any interest in natural gas? Because natural gas is so much more environmentally friendly than coal.
It still puts out CO2. It puts out about half as much as coal does, but it's, you burn it, it still puts out CO2.
Right. But I'm thinking in terms of a short range, and particularly with the automobiles too. You know, and most other countries, in fact, the Iranians are shifting their entire automobile fleet to natural gas to save money on gasoline so they can export it.
Yeah, but I don't think that that is actually the right way for the United States to go. I think that the Obama plan is actually a good one, which is to go in the direction and but much faster than Obama.
Right. So we end up with sort of focus on in automobiles, focus on the plug-in hybrids and batteries.
No doubt. The batteries exist.
Yeah.
They've been invented. They don't have to be invented. They're just expensive. They just need to be industrialized at a big scale.
Right. And the U.S., all the U.S. battery companies have formed a consortium to do that. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. Robert Bell, but thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Robert Bell, Professor of Management and Chairman of the Economics Department at Brooklyn College, City University of New York. He's the author of The Green Bubble, Waste into Wealth, The New Energy Revolution. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the assistant producer, Elliot Fong, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer,